I'm going to stay seated. I'm very tall, and I hunch over the lectern. It's awkward to look out and painful for me. So, and tall and nearsighted. Gary mentioned rightly that the causes of the decline in the Constitution are complicated, and I'm going to begin by agreeing with that, and then focus on one thing, but that with that caveat that of course there is more than many things at play here. My focus will be on what I'm going to call Rawlsian liberalism, and I don't mean to indicate that the massive popularity of people see the theory of justice, pick it up, and can't put it down, because if there is a... I would rather read Hegel's Phenomenology of Mind for bedtime reading than Rawls myself. And I like boring books, but Rawls's basic views of justice, I want to talk about them because they just cohere with what I take to be the consensus view of justice that animates especially elite thinking in America. One could say the West, too. And I don't think that I'm not going to say as a matter of historical fact all of our elites were sitting around reading Rawls. I highly doubt that. But it's more a matter of the spirit than the actual text, I guess you might say. So the Rawlsian spirit, or maybe mentality, or perhaps best of all, instinct, in the way Nietzsche uses that term, is the something people gravitate toward unthinkingly, I will argue is the principal problem those who wish to conserve the Constitution and the older American way of life face today. The Rawlsian view is the consensus view animating our managerial elite, or ruling class, and their beneficiaries and assistants. We see it manifested constantly in speech and deed, by deed I mean public policy, and on the right as well as the left. And when I mentioned the right, I think of an example. We had Ted Cruz in to speak a couple years ago, and to a shock commencement audience at Hillsdale College, this is shocking at least, probably nowhere else, he's emphasized how important it was to view all public policy through the Rawlsian lens. And Cruz is a conservative, right? I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that, but I almost fell out of my seat, but and more about what that Rawlsian lens is momentarily. Some other things that come to mind, I mean, we speak of interest groups. Not all interest groups are created equal in America anymore. If you think of the way Madison spoke of interest in Federalist 10, it's just there. Unless they're a faction, they're not a problem, right? And this example came to mind, coming back to Dallas. I lived in Dallas for about 15, 16 years. When I was a new graduate student in the area in the mid-90s, it was a common place for the Black Panthers they just shut down a highway periodically. They'd walk around with assault rifles, get on block traffic, and you couldn't do anything about that. The police were not, that's bad. There's many other groups I could name where you would see a very firm law enforcement response, and rightly so. Some students of mine were in Ann Arbor 2 weeks ago on a Saturday, and the police were helping to shut down roads to facilitate an illegal, unplanned protest. And of course, it was a melange of leftist, there's an environmental stuff and all the whatever going on. And there's lots of groups that wouldn't help do that. Of course, they shouldn't. But or to think of that it is controversial now to say America should place American interests first in its foreign policy. And that is a proposition which people will get very excited about in many cases. I have to mention there's a number of questions that are begged or merely mentioned in my remarks that maybe we're going to have a lot of time for discussion because of our small panel, and hopefully that'll work out. It'd be great if we could talk about the new left, the transformation in political institutions, the changes in private institutions. What about the churches and their new views of justice in many cases? Foreign policy, which is an interest of mine. And I'm just going to mention the relationship between Rawlsian and liberalism and the earlier progressivism. Perhaps we could talk about that. And also postmodernism, relativism, multiculturalism would be good subjects for discussion. I will also assert, and be happy to talk about this more in the discussion, that our Constitution, as originally understood, is good, and hence the decline, which we probably all agree on, is lamentable. And I will also assert, perhaps more controversially, that the decline is not caused by defects in our original principles, such as equality, or the institutional framework. Maybe we get into that too. I take the decline in the Constitution to mean, and once again to start with something we'll probably all agree on, government interfering in all sorts of things it should not be doing. And you know, you could, is it possible to glance at the news and not see government doing something that even in, say, 1900 would have been thought to be unbelievable? What are you doing? Some examples that I came to thinking about this off the top of my head, affirmative action, the entire Department of Education and all of its works and everything it does. The vast bulk of the EPA, if not all of the EPA, I think one could maybe make an argument for some of their, the IRS targeting conservatives. I mean, and we could easily spend an hour just giving examples. Perhaps more striking is that it's easy to forget, if you're interested in liberty or in the Constitution, that government doesn't do what it's supposed to do well either. So it's doing things it's not supposed to do, but it doesn't do the things it's supposed to do well. For instance, it doesn't provide equal protection of the laws or the security of rights very well at all to large parts of our population. And I like to follow what goes on in Chicago in terms of crime as an example of this. And if memory serves, just off the top of my head, I think over 600 people were murdered last year in Chicago, and about 3,500 others injured, principally by firearms, by criminal violence. And a very low percentage of people were ever charged in those crimes, about 20%. And the big thing is that people really are in our elite are concerned about is how do we talk about this in a way that won't offend people and get us yelled at? Not how do we protect people, their rights to life, the right to liberty and property. So equal, and when we talk about equal protection of the laws, what my students always want to talk about is preferences in college admissions, which, okay, that's kind of interesting, but how about protection, meaning your rights actually being secured against violence? I'm annoyed if I thought, well, I was deprived of a place because, affirmative action in education, but not as annoyed as I would be being shot, stabbed, or, you know, it's a lot worse. Genuine due process to protect the people from abuses by government in the course of securing rights is often not, it's just not really a thing. We're not that concerned about that. I mean, when we have the idea that you could have a warrant issued by a secret court that could give access to 50 or 60 million emails at a time, and one of the reasons we had a revolution was general warrants, and whatever. We have to, and it's really not that big a deal. And my favorite, well, if you're not hiding anything, you shouldn't care. Oh, I thought we liked the right to privacy now. Well, not for that. That's different. And that we could talk about how that fits the Rawlsian lens too. The promotion of your actual rights, you know, the real privileges and immunities of citizenship are important civil rights. That's not that important. Freedom of association has largely gone by the wayside. For instance, the freedom to hire and fire without having to have a massive HR department checking to see if you're complying with all these things. You know, you don't ask the candidate this, don't do this, you can't do that. Is an example that strikes me. Gun rights. Now, this is an area where there's been some genuine progress in some ways, but bitterly opposed. And I would like to know why my Michigan driver's license is accepted in Nevada or where have you know Illinois. I can't even go across the border to Illinois with a concealed carry permit. Nope, that we don't take that. That's different. Your driver's license is okay. Those rights, those are different. Okay, after that litany of complaints, I would say there are deeper problems, particularly. We have to understand, I think, the decline in the Constitution is not simply about the failure to adhere to particular constitutional provisions. The decline in the Constitution is fundamentally about the transformation of the older American way of life. Our regime, at least since the late 60s, has been oriented toward the eradication of the virtues associated with self-control and self-assertion, as well as an attack on the natural family. All of this related to it, the making of a new America through massive population transfers from other nations. You know, speaking here of the 1965 Immigration Act and its follow-on effects. The general tendency of all these measures is to embrace the death of the older America and the populace that embodied the pre-1970 regime. I'm going to stick to post-60s America, but I'll mention the progressivism, which I take to have been the dominant view of justice between about 1900 and 1965, TR to LBJ, you might say, undermined limited government, and hence I believe was pernicious, and the consent of the governed also pernicious. But in general, the way of life of ordinary Americans was not very much affected by that. Their moral life, you might say. Also, negative rights, what people like John Dewey, yes, I'm going to say some positive things about John Dewey, by way of comparison with what we have today. that's bad. Negative rights, like what he called negative rights, what the founders called natural rights, the things like life and liberty were still supposed to be protected and were still protected. Nowhere in America would it have been tolerated to have something like the violence you find in places like some neighborhoods in Chicago. Rights, including the freedom of association, mostly left intact. They were secured, and the moral life of the country was not altered in a way that transformed the traditional way of life or made freedom and decency difficult or impossible. The Great Society, the last gasp of the old progressive movement with its faith in science and the old uplift agenda, what people like Teddy Roosevelt like to call uplift, which I take to mean the perfection of man through education, enabled by the relief of want when necessary, with that perfected human beings going forth to serve others. What Richard T. Ely, the progressive political economist, called the ethical ideal. This greatly empowered government, this whole progressive agenda, but this, especially with the, by the time you get to the Great Society. This vastly expanded regime was soon put to new purposes, though. The old uplift and protection of negative rights were largely discarded in favor of the new liberal or Rawlsian orientation. And very briefly, what I take to be the key aspects of modern liberalism understood through Rawls is the demand, two core principles, many of you I'm sure know this already, but just real quick, the equality principle and the difference principle. And the equality principle, and these will supposedly be chosen by all people if they can put themselves mentally in what Rawls called an original condition, where you don't know, you have knowledge of how things work, but you don't know your own talents or the conventional privileges you might have. Then you'll embrace both these principles, the equality principle being the idea that there should be an equality of income, of political liberty, and especially and often unnoticed in the literature on Rawls, self-respect. People have a right to be respected and esteemed equally. These things were all in tension with the older, even the understanding of someone like John Dewey or Richard T. Ely or Teddy Roosevelt, where you can't respect people equally because if you're uplifting people, you're telling them you're not right, you need to be better, work harder to perfect yourself. The difference principle, Rawls, of course, admits, well, there's sometimes you have to have inequality, and this is legitimated by what he calls the difference principle, which is inequality is okay when it benefits the least advantaged. And so this obviously legitimates redistribution of things like material goods, but also self-esteem and self-respect, and legitimates the ruling class or managerial elite having special privileges, the idea being, well, they're serving the least among us, so they deserve. Sometimes conservatives will, Al Gore complains about global warming, but he flies around the globe on a private jet, and that's so hypocritical, and it's like, you don't get it. He has a perfectly clean conscience because I'm serving the least among us, so I deserve those. I mean, whether he thinks about it in explicitly Rawlsian terms, the basic, we're serving the other or the least among us, so this is good. Rawls took all natural talents and conventional privileges to be unearned and hence common property to be disposed by the community. Another important Rawlsian principle. Also, you have to be tolerant, according to Rawls, of people's life choices, except when they go against the difference in the equality principles. He says, no, you have to have a common understanding in the whole society, in the social union of social unions, in his terminology, of these things. So it's not a live and let live liberalism. It's live and let live if you're doing things that promote this type of equality. In practice, making the equality principle effectual, it's the redistribution of these primary goods, is overseen by the class of people that understands justice, what Angelo Codevilla helpfully calls the ruling class, or James Burnham called the managerial elite. This class has greater power, wealth, and prestige than the rest of the country, but that is okay because their privilege is in service to the least among us, or that's the argument. This explains the good conscience found among those liberals who live very privileged lives. Their privilege is not just okay, it is positively a good thing. The primacy of self-respect, and this means not being able to speak clearly about differences in ability or making things function. And one example of this, think of the agonized discussions in our military about gender parity. And the consideration is not how do we fight and win our nation's wars effectively, but how do we engineer the standards in such a way that in this case, women don't feel badly about themselves for not being able to do all the same things typically a man could do. So it's not the actual protection of genuine rights to life, liberty, and property, but the self-esteem of whatever group is at that time or individual being thought to be among the least among us. And this requires a decline in making anything work. So another way to helpfully see a difference between progressive America, LBJ's America, with all its problems, and today's America is they like to make things work, like the space program, the public building projects, the dams, and, you know, the recent problem with these structures in California, or the freeway fire in Atlanta yesterday. I don't know if you guys read about that. I don't think that would have happened, and it would have been fixed much more quickly in the earlier America. Wrap up quickly here, but something that also has to be noted is the collapse in reason, or what's sometimes termed postmodernism. And you can even see this within Rawls's own thought, where his famous theory of justice, he tries to say, no, a reasonable human being who puts themselves in the original position will agree with this. That's a matter of reason. And then, as Richard Rorty delights in pointing out, Rawls later said, no, that's not really, this is just what we agree on. We agree these principles are right. In other words, this is the same argument made by people like Rorty or Jürgen Habermas. Justice is what the elite, the well-credentialed, really mean, what they say it is. And we're not going to try and prove that there's a foundation in the nature of things. The cause or the effect of all this, why would people gravitate towards this Rawlsian liberalism? I mean, there's some of them benefit from it, of course, but I think you'd need a Nietzsche or a Dostoevsky to explore the soul. Why would modern Western human men and women think that this is a good way to go? Because it's really bad for the whole civilization overall, individual countries. Really quickly, some causes for hope would be, I'm optimistic about, it'd be interesting how controversial this is in this room, the Trump phenomenon. And in particular, Trump's emphasis throughout his campaign and in the opening 10 weeks of his administration on actually protecting people. I mean, for something not noticed in the continual media storms, I think, was from the beginning of his campaign all the way through, Americans should be protected in the older sense of, say, from violent crime. That's an important thing. We should actually think about, and no one could question whether these policies, is this the best way to do it, what's best for America and American citizens in terms of trade, economics, and foreign policy. Just that revolutionary statement, there's this a contrary attitude. There's this great statement by Paul Ryan I like to use in class where he says, the first thing I think about when I get up in the morning is the H-1B visa applicant waiting in line in this country trying to get. It's the first thing I think about. And I think the founders would have thought, all their controversies, you know, we should think about what's good for American citizens first. That's the whole point of having a social compact. And not to harm other people, of course, that can't be just. But so I'm going to stop there and let's go to questions.